My name is Sarah Zylstra. I represent Colby & Colby Millwork as well as their health and welfare benefit plan. Colby & Colby is a Wisconsin company in north central Wisconsin that manufactures doors and windows. They have a self-funded employee welfare benefit plan, meaning the plans are paid out of the company's general assets, and the Colby Millwork is the plan administrator. I won't recite the facts. I'll jump right into the first issue, which is whether or not our complaint pled a claim under ERISA Section 502. Great West and Sereboff together answer that question, and we undoubtedly have satisfied those requirements.
Hey, help me with this, would you? Is the only place you talk about this lockbox in your opening brief here? You don't talk about it in your rebuttal brief. I couldn't find it in the record. Is this the only place where you talk about the lockbox? And I take it the lockbox, you presume the funds are segregated, but segregation of funds is a huge issue here.
That's actually multiple questions. I'll take them in turn. The lockbox is the place that I talk about it here at the Seventh Circuit. The reason why the lockbox issue was not in the record, because this was a motion to dismiss based upon our complaint. While the court was deliberating with respect to the legal issues, some minor discovery was allowed to continue, and we found out about the lockbox during that discovery. But by that point, the court had started ruling on the legal issues. In terms of me presenting it to the Seventh Circuit, it's done in part to show that the district court did not construe reasonable inferences in our favor in considering the motion to dismiss. The second part of your question is whether or not it's a critical issue. It is, but it isn't, Your Honor. It depends.
Well, you know, you plead some theory of lien by agreement, but you don't plead the lockbox, and so do you think that under the Bell and Ashcroft cases that that you're going to have problems if we were to decide that the funds have to be segregated and then you didn't plead the segregation of funds? Are you out of business because you didn't plead the segregated funds?
No, Your Honor. First, let's stop and think about the procedural posture you would put plans in. If I have to prove that the plans are that the funds are still segregated before I get discovery, how can I do that? How can I know what defendants have done with our funds without engaging in discovery to determine that? Requiring me to plead it up front is an unfair requirement that no plan will be able to meet, at least in good faith. I could make the allegation, but it would be based on nothing. I mean, how do I get that information if not through discovery? The second thing is, I think there are at least two different ways to get equitable relief under Great West and Sereboff. With respect to equitable liens by agreement, no tracing is required. I don't have to prove that the funds were segregated, and in fact, GUTTA, that's the Seventh Circuit decision in this case, which is the main case on equitable liens, states specifically strict tracing is not required, and it doesn't matter if the funds were segregated or even if they're dissipated. If there is an equitable lien by agreement, it doesn't matter what happened to the funds. If there is equitable relief by restitution, it may. And then discovery will be necessary for us to try and trace those funds and satisfy our obligations. But coming back to Bell and what my requirements are, I've pled enough facts to suggest that I paid, or more appropriately, the plaintiffs have paid defendants. The reasonable inference is they have the money. If they want to say in front of this court that they do not, the price of admission is an answer, not a motion to dismiss where they want you to infer that fact. With respect to Great West and Sereboff, the key critical element of those cases is possession. In essence, it's an admonishment to sue the right party. Sue the party that has possession of the funds, and the relief you're requesting is equitable. We sued the proper party here. We sued the defendants, which is who the plan paid the funds to.
I know you presumed we knew the facts, and I think that's a fair presumption, and you wanted to go right to the issues, but could you help me on when Colby determined that it had made an error?
Well, with respect to the facts in the complaint and what is known at this point in time, the...
Well, I'm asking you about something that would be uniquely within the possession of the plaintiff. That is, when you determined that you had inappropriately certified this individual.
The ultimate determination that the plan was going to deny the claims and the benefits occurred on June 24, 2008.
And that was how much later than when initially allowed?
The child was born in early August of 2007. The participant, that is the Colby employee, applied for insurance August 20th of 07, which was several weeks after the child was initially born. Through the following months, the plan, as the court may be aware, the participant, Mr. Gorzynski, had left several questions blank on the form, and the plan proceeded to ask for follow-up from Mr. Gorzynski. While not precisely in the complaint, Mr. Gorzynski indicated a willingness and an intent to answer those questions and to provide the information. Ultimately, he did not, and ultimately the plan decided that it must issue a denial letter.
Well, so that I understand this, how many employees are involved with Colby? How big is the plan, I guess?
Colby and Colby has approximately between 1,500 and 1,600 employees.
And covered under this plan?
I believe so, Your Honor. That's the total number of employees, and I'm not certain.
I'm trying to get a picture. I'm trying to get the context of when and how quickly Colby addressed the error. You're seeking equitable relief here.
I am, Your Honor. And I think that Your Honor's questions are very good ones, and I actually think it goes to ultimately where I think the district court went awry in granting the motion to dismiss. And to prevent that, if you think about what the district court held first that our claim was not for equitable relief, it was for legal relief. The district court then dismissed the unjust enrichment claim and finally saying our state law claim was preempted. One of the final decisions, the district court said that, I won't quote it exactly, but in essence the district court said if Colby and Colby had decided the health or had decided the determination of coverage sooner, this would be an entirely different case. Why? What makes deciding it sooner us seeking legal relief and turn it into equitable relief? How does that make our state law claim less preempted? The timing had everything to do with the decision, but nothing to do with the legal issues that were presented by the motion to dismiss. Now, it may be that the timing comes into play in terms of the equities, but that doesn't occur on a motion to dismiss. That occurs only after you understand the facts and circumstances. Facts and circumstances such that in this industry, refunds are common. It's the way the industry works. Plans pay all the time before they know
this
the facts.
Is this an overpayment or a mispayment?
I believe it's an overpayment, Your Honor.
An overpayment would suggest that there was justification initially for payment, would it not?
It may, Your Honor. I guess overpayment is the term that's often used in the industry. I haven't seen the term mispayment used.
That's what you have here, though, right? You don't have an overpayment. You have a payment that never should have been made.
Well, the way the plan defines overpayment is any time we pay more than we should have. We paid more than we should have.
The implication of paying more than you should have is that there was a need to pay initially, right? Isn't that a fair reading of that part of it?
I don't believe so.
If you've made a mistake, if Colby has made a mistake, what breach occurred by the Medical College of Wisconsin in proceeding?
Okay. Well, with respect to, there's a difference between the state law claim and the 502 claim. The 502 claim is based on the language of Section 502, which says whenever the plan beneficiary participant seeks to enforce the terms of the plan and seeks equitable relief to do so. The terms of our plan say that we only provide coverage for eligible dependents, and to be an eligible dependent, you have to meet certain criteria. And if we make payments and that are either made in error, made after someone has terminated from Colby, or paid more than we should have, we have a right to request those overpayments back.
Would you have an action against Mr. Gorzynski?
That, I think, is the perfect question, Your Honor, for the point of why we are here today. I don't think so. I mean, I can't say for certain unless I consider all the angles, but I will...
Who misled Colby?
Well, here's the problem, Your Honor. Under Section 502 in Great Western Sereboff, Great Western Sereboff told me that I can't sue the plan participant. He never had possession of the funds. Sereboff says if you've never had possession, or Great West, the money went directly into a special needs trust, and it never passed through the participant. The Supreme Court says you can't sue the participant. Then you are seeking to enforce a contract, and you're seeking relief from their general assets, not from the money you paid them. So I have no claim, as far as I can tell, under ERISA against Mr. Kaczynski.
Could you withhold benefits from him in the future, up to the amount in dispute?
I think I would have to say I'm not certain of that, Your Honor. Not certain that we could set off in that manner, potentially. I don't know. I'd have to look at the plan language more carefully. I do know I'd have no state law claim against I don't think I'd have a state law claim against Mr. Kaczynski. My basis for seeking payment from Mr. Kaczynski would be the plan. I don't have any other contract with Mr. Kaczynski in order to enforce that. So my state law claim would be preempted. So really what the defendants are sitting here telling you today is when a plan makes a payment that it doesn't owe, they should have no remedy. No remedy whatsoever. How is that consistent with ERISA's principles? I mean, one of the main primary objectives of ERISA was to protect the soundness of plans so that the money and the benefits will be there for people who are covered under that plan. If we don't allow plans to seek overpayments, and I understand that this is not the way it would work outside the healthcare context. Outside the healthcare context, I think we'd be talking about different principles of contract law. But the fact of the matter, the industry usage and trade and standard here is very, very important to understanding this case. The defendants have refund protocols. They have specifics on how they refund money to plans. And they also have time limits on refunding money. With respect to Bowers, which was our third-party administrators, through Bowers, we have up to 12 months to seek a refund. 12 months. We were well within that time period. For certain other providers, it's unlimited. There is no time period specified. That's North Central Health Alliance, which is our other, because Medical College, we have a different.
Are those refund situations dealing with errors in billing or overcharging? What are they at all analogous to our situation of providing services to somebody who couldn't receive them?
I believe they apply in that instance, too.
No, I understand. I know you believe that. I'm asking, do we have a case where there is a situation where there's authorization to the medical provider and eventual payment, and there's a mistake made, and it's found that the recovery can be had against the medical provider?
I'd have
something similar to our case.
Your Honor, I think the most I don't recall a case where a person was not covered. Specifically in the case law that I've cited to you, I do know, there are plenty of instances where a procedure is not covered and those kinds of things. But I think to the extent that the refund protocols and those types of things intrigue you, and
those protocols speak to the initial appropriateness of a decision to cover someone. In other words, if you've given A is sent for care, and in the process of giving care, there's either an overcharge or whatever. But there isn't a situation where the wrong person was sent for the care.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I will find it. I guess what I'm saying is I'll find it in the protocol during my time when the other side's arguing. I think it states that it covers situations as this. I will say that with respect to this particular ineligible participant, there were 14 healthcare providers, 12 provided full refunds. Children's Hospital refunded two of our payments.
For what? Why was
for this particular child, Children's Hospital refunded two out of the many payments we made. They were approximately $4,300 that they returned to us, but wouldn't return the rest.
Yeah, well.
Why would they refund two payments?
What were the totals? Again, 43?
I want to say, without the exact dollar amount, it's about $4,300.
Well, that's somewhat de minimis, I suspect, in the context of this case. And I'm not suggesting that there was a decision based on either potential litigation or otherwise, but we're talking here excess of $1.5 million, are we not?
We are. We are, Your Honor. But the other 12 also. And it may be that it may be de minimis, but it also goes to show somewhat the industry standard.
Well.
Your Honor, I can see that you may disagree with that.
Disagreeing or agreeing, I'm just trying to understand the culpability of the medical college. Is it should they be slower in accepting someone like the medical college, slower in providing care, and require some sort of documentation from Colby that they have run the trap, so to speak, on the appropriateness of care for this individual?
There are two responses to that, I guess, Your Honor. First of all, as the little discovery we were able to accomplish tells you, they would have provided care whether there was insurance or not. I mean, they actually started providing care before Mr. Grzynski even applied for insurance. They had no expectation that there would be any insurance coverage for this child. It's within their mission to provide care in these instances, and if insurance is there, they'll pursue that. If it's not, they won't. So there isn't any sort of detrimental reliance here, as far as I can tell. And second, Your Honor, I guess I would say this. I think we come back to it being a motion to dismiss. I think I should have the opportunity to develop the instances in which children's hospitals and medical college have refunded payments, including large payments for non-covered dependents or others, instances in which they have refunded payments that may even involve Colby and Colby, to find out the other 12 providers, to provide in the record how they have operated in the situation. I think all of that goes to what the reasonable expectations were of the parties. And I think, but my complaint, I think, satisfies Bell standard of at least alleging the necessary facts to get me there. I do want to take a moment to talk in terms of Central States versus Neural Behavior and Trustmark. Central States versus the district court, I think, went awry because the district court held that Great West and Sereboff states that those cases are no longer good law. That is an error this court has to correct. Great West and Sereboff had nothing to do with the issues that were in Neural Behavior and Trustmark. The district court, in my mind, conflated two issues. The first is whether we're seeking equitable relief. That's Great West and Sereboff. That says, did we sue the party that had possession of the funds? If so, it's equitable. We're seeking to get that money back. If we sue a party that doesn't have the funds, we are seeking their general assets. That's impermissible. We sued the party that we believed have the funds, and we've alleged that. Central States versus Neural Behavior and Trustmark tell us that we're allowed to sue medical providers who have the funds. I think the district court thought that the equitable relief provisions of Great West and Sereboff, Great West and Sereboff don't establish that we can pursue medical providers because Great West and Sereboff involve plan participants. Neural Behaviors and Trustmark answer that question. And I think those cases are still good law, and I think this court needs to reaffirm that provision. With respect to the assignment, that's another issue that I think the district court has created some law that's perhaps not consistent with the assignment law that exists by this circuit. Central States and Trustmark established that the defendants are statutory beneficiaries under ERISA. And Harris Trust from the U.S. Supreme Court says that 502 does not delineate the defendants that you can sue under 502. I think that's enough for us to get equitable relief. But even if it were not, we have the assignment in this case. The defendants got an assignment from Mr. Grzynski, and through that assignment, they sought plan funds. The district court disregarded or said with respect to the assignment that Mr. Grzynski only assigned his insurance benefits and not his obligations under the plan, and that therefore they could pursue the money for their services without having to be subject to the corresponding obligations of payment under the plan. That is in direct conflict with this circuit's decision in Decatur Memorial. In Decatur Memorial, the court stated that an assignee of benefits under an ERISA plan becomes a statutory beneficiary, and with this designation comes all limitations on beneficiaries' entitlements. Even if the plan assigned only his benefits, I mean, even if you want to say that the assignment only did his benefits, Mr. Krasinski can only assign the benefits he had. He can't assign more benefits than what he had. And I see my time is up, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Zelstra. Mr. Hoekstra?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin this morning by addressing plaintiff's ERISA claim, particularly focusing some of the key areas where we have a difference of opinion on the application of Section 502A3 of ERISA. Now, in shorthand, that section reads that a civil action may be brought by a fiduciary to obtain appropriate equitable relief to enforce the terms of the plan. The crux of the issue here is whether or not the plaintiffs have stated a plausible claim for equitable relief under this provision of ERISA. Now, the plaintiffs have spent considerable energy trying to say that Central States and Trustmark stand for the proposition that they can sue medical care providers. But as they've said in both of their briefs and repeated here this morning, the question of what constitutes equitable relief under ERISA is not addressed in Central States or Trustmark. Those questions are answered by the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Great West and Sereboff. Now, in shorthand, what Sereboff in particular says is that in order for a claim to constitute equitable relief under ERISA, it has to satisfy two requirements. First, the nature of the relief sought must be equitable. That's where the plaintiffs are arguing, well, we had possession. But there's a second piece of the Sereboff analysis which is all but ignored, and that is that the basis of the claim has to be equitable. In other words, it has to be a claim that would have been recognized in a court of equity. We do not believe that the plaintiffs have stated a plausible claim here that would have been recognized in a court of equity. They've argued extensively that there's an equitable lien by agreement between them and the defendants. Under Sereboff, in order for an equitable lien by agreement to exist, it has to satisfy two requirements. First, the agreement in question has to identify a specific fund in the possession of the defendants that's pledged as a security. And second, the agreement has to identify a share of that fund to which the plaintiff is entitled. Now note, an equitable lien by agreement requires that the fund that's identified be the source of repayment, which in a lien context makes sense, because if there's a separation between the two, all the agreement has done is created legal relief. That's where we believe the plan's language falls short. The plan language reserves a right to recover against a covered person for payments made to third parties. In other words, the plan language separates the source of repayment, the covered person, from the identified fund, payments to third parties, and creates on its face legal relief. And so the plan language falls short here.
Did the plaintiff have to allege the segregated fund, the segregated monies, in order to make plead a valid cause of action?
We believe that they at least have to have alleged possession, that there's possession of those funds. Plaintiffs are correct in equitable lien by agreement. Strict tracing is not required, but they at least have to allege possession, and we don't even believe they've alleged possession, as Your Honor noted. The whole issue of this segregated bank account was never alleged. It was not in the record, as far as I know, about any type of a segregated fund in the defendant's possession. But more important to the district court's finding, even if there was an equitable lien somehow created by the plan language, the district court was correct in ruling that the equitable lien does not apply to defendants because defendants are not a party to the agreement that created that purported lien, in other words, the plan. And as such, the plaintiffs cannot show that the defendants in any way agreed to repay the alleged overpayments. Now, the plaintiffs say that this doesn't matter, that the cases of Central States and Trustmark of this circuit permitted a health care plan to sue a provider and therefore they must be able to sue the health care providers in this case. Now, aside from the fact that neither of those cases addressed even the concept of an equitable lien or equitable lien by agreement, even if the plan purports to create that type of a lien, Central States just doesn't stand for the proposition that the equitable lien by agreement can then be asserted against a party that was not a party to that agreement. Plaintiffs at this point try to expand the reach of the plan language. They argue, first of all, that there's an assignment in place and that this assignment then somehow creates an equitable lien by agreement as to the defendants. Well, there are several issues with that argument. First of all, as plaintiffs just stated here, there probably is no claim against Mr. Grzynski. If there's no claim against Mr. Grzynski, how can he assign anything to the defendants? But more important, under plaintiff's theory of the case, there's nothing to assign. The language of the assignment specifically says, I hereby assign any benefits to which plaintiff is entitled, or to which patient is entitled, to the defendant medical care providers. If, as the plaintiffs contend, KG was not a covered person, this assignment is meaningless, because KG was not entitled to any benefits. If she wasn't entitled to benefits, there was nothing to assign. She couldn't assign a purported obligation to repay overpayments. Plaintiffs want to have it both ways. They can't, though. They can't argue that KG should be treated as a covered person for purposes of validating the assignment, but then not treated as a covered person for purposes of her entitlement to benefits under the plan. The district court is also correct in concluding that the assignment in this case is limited. It's the assignment limited to the assignment of insurance benefits and didn't carry with it automatically all of the obligations which might otherwise apply to the plan participant. Nobody would argue, for example, that the assignment carried with it all the obligations of the participant to pay co-payments, for co-insurance, for deductibles. The cases cited by the plaintiffs all involved an assignee's attempt to collect payments. In the ERISA cases in particular, Decatur Memorial Hospital and Franciscan Skemp, the issue of whether the plan was a beneficiary was important in those cases because the plaintiffs brought their claim under Section 502A1B of ERISA, which grants standing only to participants and beneficiaries. This is not that type of a claim. The second way that the plaintiffs try to extend the plan language, to expand the scope to reach the defendants here, is by referencing the provider agreements, the network that the defendants signed on to. Now, first, it's important to point out what the plaintiffs are not arguing. They're not arguing that the provider agreements themselves create an equitable lien by agreement. There's nothing in the agreements to support that type of assertion. Instead, they're trying to use the references to the plan in those provider agreements to somehow expand the reach of the plan language to include the defendants. In the reply brief in particular, the plaintiffs state that the provider agreements explicitly provided that defendants are subject to the Colby plan. Your Honors, this is not in those agreements. Provider agreements don't contain that type of language. The provider agreements, the purpose of those agreements is to define how much the providers would accept as payment for services when those services are covered by a plan that's a party to that network. There's no language in the agreements whereby the providers have agreed to be bound by the terms of the plan or even purporting to create an equitable lien by agreement as to health care providers. Now, with regard to equitable restitution, a second theory of equitable relief that the plaintiffs discussed in their argument this morning, I would just say, point out a couple of things. First of all, this argument was never raised below. This argument, in our view, has been waived by the plaintiffs. Second, as Your Honor pointed out, strict tracing in those cases is required, not just that they had some possession at some point, but there needs to be a strict tracing of those funds to support this type of a theory. And there's nothing in the complaint whereby the plaintiffs have alleged that they could satisfy a strict tracing requirement. Moreover, that type of claim requires unjust enrichment on the part of the defendants. And this Court's cases in both Central States versus Pathology Labs and in Trustmark ruled that there's nothing improper about a health care provider being paid the market fee for their services. There's nothing unjust about that. Even if it's an alleged overpayment, there's nothing unjust about them being paid the value of their services when they have an honest claim for that money. In the few moments that I have left, I'd like to briefly address the remaining claims that the plaintiffs have brought. First, the federal common law unjust enrichment claim. It's true. This court has recognized the existence of a federal common law claim in the shadow of ERISA when a gap exists in ERISA's enforcement provisions. In this case, however, there's simply no gap to fill. Gaps exist when Congress has been silent on a particular issue. Congress, in this case, was not silent. It expressly stated that fiduciaries can bring claims under Section 502A3 of ERISA only for equitable relief. If this court creates a federal common law claim in favor of the plaintiffs, that would circumvent 502A3 if the court also finds that the plaintiffs are forbidden from bringing that claim as a fiduciary. There's no case cited by the plaintiffs where the court has found that the plaintiffs in that case were prohibited from bringing an ERISA 502A3 claim, where the court then created a federal common law claim in favor of the plaintiffs. Now, the plaintiffs here try to do an end run around that in two ways. They say, first, they're not just bringing this claim as a fiduciary, but also as an employer. And second, they're also bringing it as a plan. Now, with regard to their employer argument, the problem is they're not just an employer. They're also a fiduciary. In the cases cited by the plaintiffs, where the court created a federal common law cause of action, the plaintiff was just an employer. They were not also a fiduciary with respect to the plan. Congress had been silent. Again, in this case, Congress has spoken. With regard to their argument that they're bringing this claim as a plan, the simple fact is a plan always acts through its fiduciaries. It's exactly what this court found last year in the case of Line Construction Benefit Fund versus Allied Electrical Contractors, where it said any and all actions taken by a plan are done by the administrators who act on its behalf. In other words, by the fiduciaries who exercise discretionary authority or control with respect to the management of the plan. They can't do an end run around their fiduciary limitation by saying they're trying to bring this claim as a plan. With respect to the state law breach of contract claim, the district court is correct in concluding this claim should be preempted by Section 514 of ERISA because it will require interpretation of the plan as to who is a covered person, who is an eligible defendant. Now, the issue of preemption...
Let me just stop you there. If the district court is correct that ERISA doesn't provide any avenue for recovery under this claim, doesn't that in some way support an argument for state law relief? Because if the claim for reimbursement is not something ERISA will allow, how can it really relate to the statutory scheme? Isn't it sort of the implication? I mean, when you look at the district court's reasoning, it leaves Colby in a catch-22. Its claim for repayment isn't allowable under ERISA, but it still involves ERISA enough that other theories are preempted.
You're right, Your Honor. It does leave plaintiffs in a catch-22. But the problem is this court has also found in several instances where a claim, state law claim, requires interpretation of a plan, it falls within the definition of Section 514 of ERISA that it relates to the plan and is preempted. And there have been other decisions of this court where a plaintiff has essentially been left without a remedy.
Well, that's what I that's my next point is that the bottom line is you're saying there's no possible way at all a plan that Colby can recover in this situation.
In this particular case, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
So what if a plan had paid benefits to the wrong hospital? A beneficiary gets treated at Hospital A. The plan mistakenly sends the check to Hospital B. The Hospital B won't give the money back. Could the plan sue then?
Well, Your Honor, there may be a couple theories of relief. Number one, whether it's an equitable restitution claim, again, which has not been argued by plaintiffs as far as equitable restitution and unjust enrichment. In that case, Your Honor, the hospital would not have been paid the reasonable fee for the value of its services. There may be a basis to argue that unjust enrichment should apply, and there would be equitable relief. Also, if it's a claim that does not require any interpretation of the plan, then a state law claim could perhaps proceed. For example, in this court's decision, and I believe it's the Biondi case, the court found in that case that it did not require interpretation of the plan. It was essentially a fraudulent claim that was made. And everybody agreed that the plan language didn't provide coverage, but the question was whether the case could proceed on the basis that, on a state law basis, in light of the fact the plan was not required to be interpreted, and the court said that was appropriate.
Well, aren't there policy reasons that we might find that preemption doesn't apply here? I mean, the point behind the preemption provision is to prevent state laws from interfering with the broad goals of ERISA's statutory scheme.
You're correct, Your Honor. But I would point out to the Supreme Court's directive in the Pilot Life case, where basically it said that the policy choices that are reflected in ERISA reflect essentially a compromise. They reflect that there are some remedies that are excluded under ERISA. And the court said that the policy choices would be completely undermined if ERISA participants and beneficiaries were free to obtain remedies under state law that Congress rejected in ERISA. So policy arguments aside, the fact is this is an intent of Congress. That is, that they intentionally enacted ERISA with a limited enforcement scheme and a very broad state law preemption provision in Section 514.
Well, Colby is bringing this breach claim to achieve its goals, and a state contract claim could aid in the enforcement of the ERISA plan in this instance and not really contradict it.
Well, Your Honor, I would ask that the court also consider the state law breach of contract claim in light of the fact that we're not just talking about evaluating the propriety of the plan's determination going forward from that June of 2008 date. It's not an issue in this case. We have to look at the state law claim also in light of the fact that the plan paid for 8 months nearly $1.7 million to the defendants before then attempting to retroactively revoke coverage. To the extent that ERISA is designed to promote the proper administration of plans, it would seem that this was not just a proper administration of this plan. Moreover, to the merits of the state law claim, the fact that the plan paid seems to undermine a plausible state law claim. Their theory of relief here is that the defendants breached the provider agreements by billing for services that the defendants for all good reason, believe were covered services under the plan. And it was because the plaintiffs later determined they weren't covered that somehow that was a breach of the agreement. It's illogical to say that that's a breach when the plan paid. It's not a plausible theory.
But you're alleging facts. You're talking about facts we don't know about yet in this motion to dismiss.
Your Honor,
we don't know if the hospital was put on notice that there's a dispute. That they're paying them under protest. We don't know any of that at this point in time and not allowed really to consider the argument you're making.
But I still come back to the fact that the district court properly concluded this will require an interpretation of the plan. If the plaintiff's state law claim is allowed to proceed, the plan must be interpreted in order to determine whether KG was a covered person, in order to determine who is an eligible dependent under the plan, in order to determine whether or not the plan can retroactively revoke benefits. And the primary reason that the state law claim was dismissed is because of Section 514 of ERISA, because it will require interpretation of the plan. And because...
Well, I understand that, but I'm saying is I don't think the argument about whether or not it was rightful for them to pay before and then to go back and say, well, now we've decided that we shouldn't have paid, that's not an appropriate argument at this stage in the litigation.
But the theory that they have argued is that it was improper for the defendants to bill under the provider agreements. And that under that theory, it seems very odd to say that it's improper to bill when the plaintiffs turned around and paid. Your Honors, in the time that I have left, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions on these issues or the attorney's fees, which we'll just say we feel the district court was well within its discretion. And for the reasons just stated, we would ask that the district court opinions be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hoekstra. Ms. Zilstra, your time had expired, but I'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
And can you just address this contract claim for me? Because you're relying not on a direct agreement between you and the hospital, but on your status as a third-party beneficiary to contracts between the hospital and its network providers, contracts which involve indirect reference to the plan.
Correct, although the contracts themselves actually identify on an exhibit who are third-party beneficiaries and make us explicitly a third-party beneficiary entitled to enforce those contracts. So that's written into the agreements, the provider agreements. The reason why it requires no interpretation of the plan is because we will not go back and litigate coverage over this individual. Mr. Gerzinski authorized Medical College of Wisconsin and Children's Hospital to appeal the decision of no coverage for the child. They chose not to do so. That's done. They had 180 days to appeal. They didn't. Coverage is now determined. In addition, in terms of the payment and the issues, I think Your Honor is correct. That's not appropriate on a motion to dismiss. But keep in mind the amicus brief that you received plays well in here. Hospitals benefit from prompt payment, and there are statutes that require prompt payment. It's why plans pay within 30 days. Rarely do they have all the coverage determination information to determine it within 30 days. But they pay under those provisions because there's this entire refund industry, and that's why it works. We have not waived a claim for equitable relief by restitution. Defendants are just wrong about that. We alleged a claim under 502, and we said our relief was equitable. What we said to the district court was that we couldn't trace. We couldn't allege where the funds were now because we don't have that information in front of us. That's not waiving the argument for restitution. So in terms of that argument, I think that's wrong. Unjust enrichment, the minor gap theory. This circuit hasn't actually adopted that minor gap theory. That's the Fifth Circuit's theory. Personally, I don't think you should. It doesn't make sense. When you consider basically what defendants are saying is that you should only use common law when you have a 502 claim. And if you don't have a 502 claim, you can't look to the common law. It's the opposite under congressional intent. The federal common law was to provide abilities to handle situations that aren't covered explicitly by ERISA, but that further ERISA's goals. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.